Take a network break. Help yourself to a virtual donut and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. Today we're talking about a raft of products from Cisco, international IP address shenanigans, financial results, and more. We're sponsored in part by Palo Alto Networks. You can enable secure access for your remote workers from anywhere with Palo Alto Networks Prisma Access, a cloud-delivered Tier 1 network. Prisma Access offers comprehensive network security in a single services edge platform designed for all traffic, all applications, and all users. You can find out more at paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. And stay tuned after the news. We've got a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Aruba Networks on its Fabric Composer software. This automates the provisioning of your data center network underlay and overlay, plus other features for orchestration, visibility, and troubleshooting. All right, Greg, welcome to our Friday recording. Let's dive into the news. Cisco, they have announced several new products in their Catalyst 8000 Edge portfolio, including the 8500L. This is an appliance for 1 gig and 10 gig WAN aggregation. Cisco's positioning this to be deployed in enterprise aggregation sites or colo sites.
Yeah, it's an interesting product in the sense that watching Cisco continue to produce hardware that's quite Cisco-like, if you know what I'm saying, in the sense that it's SD-WAN is about using commodity to hardware for most SD-WAN vendors. You just go and buy a server from, you know, one of the white box makers. You get it into a box. You get some paint and then put your logo on the outside. You put a bunch of them in a warehouse. And then you run some generic software on top and call it an SD-WAN solution. And Cisco, on the other hand, is maintaining it sort of, we've got special boxes. They're engineered to certain degrees. They run, you know, and they have these custom interfaces. And sort of leveraging off their existing customer base. So if you've got weird things like T1s and E1s and you want to run SD-WAN off that, most other companies would need a router because they're not going to go to the trouble of creating legacy interfaces for a 50-year-old technology. So, you know, it's sort of playing to Cisco's strengths in the market, but it's a weird product family if you sort of look at it because it no one else makes a box quite like this in a way.
Well, I guess, you know, in some ways that's Cisco's way, that they've always talked about their hardware and software being better together. So they're sort of sticking with that.
Yeah, they are still sort of selling that vertically integrated model. You know, you get the hardware from Cisco, you get the proprietary software from Cisco that has the openness, you know, to the outside, but not internally so much. And then increasingly they're saying our software-defined capabilities or our software-defined networking, the bulk of them. They've got some open networking SDN-type tools like Network Service Orchestrator and so forth. But, you know, when you start talking about the SD-WAN stuff, you know, the Viptela or the Campus, they're very much Cisco's proprietary SDN solution running on Cisco's proprietary NOS on Cisco's proprietary hardware, and no deviation will be permitted, which is fine. A lot of customers like that approach, and you know where you stand, if you will.
Yes, you always do.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe there's something in that.
And as part of this announcement, they've introduced an entire new line in the 8000 series. They're launching the 8200 series. This is a whole bunch of products, including branch routers that support 1 gig links for SD-WAN and SASE use cases. I think they're aiming at a replacement for the ISR 4300 line.
Yeah, I think so. You know, obviously the branding here, I'm looking at this as the Catalyst 8000. And what Cisco's doing is a bit like what iPhone's doing. You know, you have iPhone 10, 8, 12, and you know that when the iPhone 14 comes out that yours is obsolete, if that makes
sense,
right?
Right.
So what
yes.
Cisco's signaling here with the naming is the Catalyst is enterprise, you know, and other boxes in the portfolio get named differently. And it sort of reflects the internal organization of Cisco, because now in previous generations there was the data center business unit and they had the Nexus, and then over here was the you know, the campus unit and they had Catalyst, and the routers were called all different names, XR, XE, you know, whatever. And as these business units are all being unified into a single strategy, you're starting to see the product portfolio reflect the business. So and that's a common saying in business terms, is that, you know, the product portfolio reflects the internal organization of the company that made it. And that's certainly the case here. And the naming convention here of 8000 is the 8000 is the current generation across the Cisco board. And the day that they decide to bring out the 9000 or the 10000 is the signifier that it's either that you're going to work into an upstep. There's a TikTok sort of thing emerging here. Cisco doesn't want you to sit on top of all of this for the next, you know, however long it's going to be that, you know, you do these sorts of things. So
that's right. Mm. Yep. So links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Sticking with Cisco, they've got a new line of Catalyst micro switches. These are designed for fiber to the desk or fiber to the office. They're small form factor and fanless, so they can be quiet operationally, and they're supporting power over Ethernet and a variety of gigabit fiber and copper ports.
It took me a while to sort of twig to an angle for this story, Drew. I sort of looked at it and thought, like, you know, how I can take a four-port switch and turn it into from a $40 unit into a $1,000 unit, which is a snarky take. And not entirely wrong. You know, like the Catalyst micro switch is a desk mount model, four ports of gigabit Ethernet, two USB-C ports so you can charge your phone from it, power over Ethernet there. So if you've got somebody's desk, or maybe you're doing a little corner of a room, or you're doing a janitor's closet or something similar, you can actually put a little switch in there that's going to give you, you know, power and all the things that you actually sort of want, right? But the wall jack model really got me interested because it's actually presenting four gigabit ports to the front. So think about it like a power socket. And then the side of the switch is actually two Ethernet ports. One's a copper and one's a SFP. So you can now run, you know, copper through the walls and then connect this to the wall and it stands out. Unfortunately, it's a bit visually and displeasing because it stands off by about an inch. But, you know, okay, it's not flush mount like a socket is. It's still fairly beefy.
Right.
And I thought, you know, that's really interesting because do you remember a couple of years ago Cisco was telling us how excited they were that lighting was going to be a new market opportunity for them?
Right, and, you know, enterprise or industrial lighting with, you know.
Yeah, the idea was is that a 48-port switch was the best way to power lights in a building, and which I always thought was kind of entertaining. The idea that you would spend, you know, $15,000 on a on a Cisco switch to control your lighting always seemed a bit ambitious to me, and I'm not sure that that went very well. The idea that a switch is a power supply for lighting and you get Ethernet and you get a bunch of other things. This seems more like the intention behind that idea was that Cisco was saying why, you know, everybody needs more Ethernet. Everybody needs more capabilities in this sense, and lighting has gone on to do it wirelessly. So we've seen like the Hues and the, you know, and all those types of Zigbee standards for turning lights on and off and the development of temperature sensors and things like that. The market's pretty much decided that is not wired, that's wireless. So that market didn't emerge. This feels more realistic. This idea that Ethernet everywhere, you can have a wall-mounted socket with four Ethernets, you just plug it into a cable and then it's connected to the network and then you report back to an SDN controller. So, you know, these lights have a central controller, like a Hue has a Hue bridge. There's some sort of central engine that does a software-defined angle to it, and this feels sustainable to me. This feels like what Cisco should have done, but they tried to force the market in a direction it didn't go, I think.
Yeah, I was wondering about this because I'm thinking, you know, a little switch on the desk, that's great that it's quiet, but most folks are accessing the network wirelessly. So maybe there's a few use cases where power users or particular applications require a very fast hardwired connection, or maybe for industrial use cases or hospitals where you've got devices you want to connect over a wire. I guess maybe that's where they're going with this.
Yeah, well, so I was thinking, and there's a picture in the blog post if you want to see it. It's quite cute. Little thing in its way. Shame they wrote scribbled over the front of it. They should have just left it plain, really. But I think there'll be a lot of vertical solutions that'll get it. Like if you think about a radiology room in a hospital and you need to put Ethernet ports in because wireless is obviously not good. If you're buying, you know, if you're spending $6 or $7 million on a radiology solution, having Cisco come in and do the switches is not a bad idea.
Yes. A Cisco switch is probably a little cheaper than an MRI machine.
Yeah, that's right. You know, when it's just folded into the solution, it's one of those things like, you know, when you're a public cloud provider, the cost of the network is actually trivial compared to the overall cost of what's happening. So, you know, so what if it, you know, it's only 5%? So making a 20% cost reduction doesn't really move the needle. So this is interesting in that sense. And they're only partially industrially rated. So I don't see them being used in the factory, although, you know, being wall mounted, no power, no fans, low noise means they run in offices and things like that. But I could imagine things like a room full of printers where before you would run five cables down to a central switch, just run one cable to the room and then run one of these. It's not like printers need the bandwidth. And then, as you say, you know, sensors and stuff like that. Lots of interesting ways to do like a star network architecture. Like you run one cable up to this thing and then connect it to the sensor. So, yeah, I think Cisco's onto something here. I think this is a much more practical and probably the path they should have taken 3 or 4 years ago instead of pursuing the ideas that they came out with.
Yeah. Well, I guess when it first comes out, you just got to sell what you have. And now they've kind of come around with a new product for that market.
Yeah, I thought that. But then I thought, you know, there's sometimes when the company says, well, we'll sell what we have and see, you know, see if anybody bites on the idea. But at the same time, you're also poisoning the well. Like if you come out with an impractical solution and you say to customers, well, this is what we've got. We've got this standard 48-port switch with all the power supplies. Why don't you buy that? And then 3 years later, people have gone like, yeah, Cisco's off in a crazy, you know, that company's gone off in a crazy direction. We should just drop it. You know, we don't need to talk to them again. Cuts both ways. So
it does. All right. Well, as always, links in the show notes if you want to check it out. And if you think maybe you're in the market for this, or maybe you have some insight onto Cisco strategy here, you can always hit us up at packetpushers.net/FU. That's FU for follow-up.
Yeah. Love to hear from you. You know, and if I'm misunderstanding something or if Drew's misunderstanding something, you know, send it in and we'll always publish the follow-up back onto the show so that it's, and we don't necessarily have to mention your name or where you're from, but we are interested in getting it right or exposing everybody's view. So if my take isn't correct, let's have a debate and then put that into public.
Absolutely. All right, moving on. Fortinet, they've announced a new security product called FortiXDR. It combines endpoint security with cloud-based analytics to provide more automated detection of and response to incidents and attacks. So essentially, you've got an endpoint agent device that's sending telemetry to the cloud for analysis. And Fortinet says the cloud service can detect and respond to attacks like blocking a user from going to a known bad phishing domain, that kind of thing.
So, you know, we talked before about firewall companies adding security functions, more like the software inspection, deep inspection capabilities. This feels like continuing down that path. Obviously, Fortinet has IPSs and so forth, but this actually goes a step further. Was there anything that stood out for you in the briefing?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, Fortinet's got what they call the FortiFabric or the Fortinet Fabric, where all of their Fortinet devices, their firewalls, their IPSs, their switches, their APs can all share and send telemetry up to essentially a data lake for, you know, analysis and correlation and so on. And I guess it seems to me like this FortiXDR is sort of an additional analytical layer on top of all that data to do this detection and response, because so much information is coming at security operators that humans essentially can't really handle it.
Yes.
So you need some kind of analytical system to sort of parse through everything that's going on, put together some kind of chain of events, and then help you either automate a response by saying, you know, block this port on a firewall or send this command to a desktop to keep it off the network, or at least say, here's all the stuff we've gathered about what looks like maybe some kind of lateral movement in the organization. You can respond, analyze it and respond to it.
So it sounds a bit like, at the risk of making a gross metaphor, but it sounds a bit like this idea of what SD-WAN did to WAN. Centralized a lot of the functions, simplified, gathered the data into one place, gives you configuration management, centralized logging, visibility tooling, you know, that sort of stuff. Sort of conceptually like that.
I guess that's a good way to think of it in that, yeah, you have one place now where you're looking to do your investigation and response, and there's potentially automated capabilities you can turn on if you're comfortable and you trust the system to make those automated decisions for you. Yes, I think that's a legitimate comparison.
So, yeah, that makes sense. Like what we learned from SDN is that, you know, SDN in the data center, be it NSX doing software switching at the edge or ACI doing a sort of like a hardware form of SDN operations and configuration type stuff. The same thing applies to the WAN as it does to the campus. So logically it applies to security as well. So I guess they're walking down that path, bring in all of the pieces. So they've acquired a lot of companies to do like threat management, pattern detection, you know, that sort of stuff, and various bits of technology with ML and AI and so forth. That makes sense to round out the portfolio and say, okay, our firewalls become an edge network. What are you going to call it? SD security? I don't know. SD phone, but whatever.
Yeah, I think it definitely gives Fortinet sort of a soup to nuts security story they can tell customers. We can protect your endpoints. We can protect your data center network. We can protect your campus net. We've got all the pieces you need: firewall, SIEM, IDS, IPS, malware detection, and now on top of that, we've got this nice analytics and response detection engine. To bring it all together and to help make sense of all of it. And I think that's where I think we're going to see security going, helping us make sense of all this reams of information that we're getting. You're going to see a lot of security companies, I think, going this way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
As always, links in the show notes if you want more.
Yeah.
All right, a quick note from our sponsor today, Palo Alto Networks. Multitudes of employers are working remotely, which means your networking and security infrastructure have to make corporate resources available 24/7, and that's not going to be temporary. In fact, 76% of global workers want the option to continue working remotely for at least part of the time. Moving to a predominantly remote workforce will strain existing infrastructure, so organizations are grappling with the limitations of their architectures, predominantly around scalability, security, and performance. Palo Alto Networks wants to help you scale your remote workforces without compromise. You can enable secure access from anywhere with Palo Alto's Prisma Access, a cloud-delivered Tier 1 network service. Prisma Access delivers comprehensive network security in a single services edge platform designed for all traffic, all applications, and all users. You can find out more at paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. That's paloaltonetworks.com/secure-remote-workforces. Thank Palo Alto for being a sponsor, and let's get back to the news. A story has come to light recently that an executive at AFRINIC, which handles IP address allocation for the African continent, has been misallocating IPv4 addresses and selling them off under various private companies for millions of dollars.
It's a great story, isn't it? Lots of skullduggery and so forth.
Skullduggery and individual sleuthing, too.
Yeah, exactly. It's quite a story. Let me try, jump in on me, because there's a lot going on in this story, and it's easy to get it mixed up. So AFRINIC, of course, is the NIC organization, the registry for African countries, in the same way that we've got ARIN for the US, and we've got RIPE for Europe, and LACNIC for Latin America, and APNIC for Asia Pacific, and so forth. And they've been responsible for managing the IP address pool. And at some point around the 2013-2014 timeframe, somebody working for the AFRINIC started to issue IP addresses basically to anybody who would pay the money. And this sort of went on for quite a few years before an individual named Rod Gilmet. And he's an independent researcher who sort of tracked down this misuse. Now, what's interesting about Ron Gilmet is that he is actually looking for a way to take 8kun and 8chan off the network. And he does that by researching their infrastructure and saying, how do we take them down? And he realized that they actually owned these illegal IP addresses that were used incorrectly. And the whole thing eventually came to light. Is that your take as well?
Yeah, so he actually saw what was going on. He was looking at IPv4 addresses and wondering how they were being reallocated. And apparently just sort of found this suspicious. So he contacted some journalists and investigators in South Africa, and they started looking into it. And then they ran it all the way up the chain to AFRINIC. So AFRINIC launched an official audit, and then there's an official report that says this person took more than 2.3 million V4 addresses, and we know that V4 can be resold for a tidy sum on the private market because folks are so want V4 because it's, you know, they're essentially done now. So he sold them for about $50 million. AFRINIC now says they've recovered about 1 million to date. So there's still a lot out there they still need to go after.
Yeah, and it's fascinating, the whole discovery here. And 2.3 million V4 addresses in 2014 to 2018, I think, is kind of. Mm-hmm. And you think of that those IP addresses are worth $20 each today. That's like.
You get enough of them, that's a tidy
that's
sum.
That's a tidy sum. Now, it turns out that a lot of these addresses actually dribbled down to undesirable organizations because they were sort of bought on the dodgy and they were sold to dodgy companies. We'll come to that in the next piece. So I think here, there's a couple of things here, and that is, we, as networking professionals, as we use the public network more and more and more, the controls and the regulations around things like IP addresses and BGP ASNs and the ability of the internet to be safe and secure, this is actually a threat in that direction. If people can get IP addresses, they can do things with them. And it's sort of a shame that AFRINIC was just left to run on its own and it wasn't able to detect this sort of corruption.
Yeah, in its report, AFRINIC says it has added additional verification layers for allocation and database updates and more training for their staff, because I'm sure this is a not a good look for them.
No. And I think the other NICs will also be taking closer looks at themselves to see if there was any misappropriations, I'm sure. Right. And no doubt they will probably follow up on the AFRINIC over time. I imagine the ISOC will be having a bit of taking a closer look at what's actually happening in the NICs, because I think they've actually got oversight. Ultimate oversight over that, although I've expressed my concerns about whether ISEC is keeping it together. But it's a great story, and I think that we as networking professionals should also be doing more to watch this. So if you see something, You need to find a way to come up with it. And that's the challenge. I don't know. If I saw somebody owning addresses that I didn't know, what do I do with them? You know, where do I go with that information? Who do I talk to? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
How do you report an abuse of the system? Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah. How do you contact RIPE or APNIC or whatever? I don't know. But somebody, I mean, Ron Gilmet apparently found a way. And there's another story that involves Ron Gilmet and IPv4. He's also blown the whistle on the Russian hosting provider DDoSGuard, which, in apparent effort by DDoSGuard to get more IPv4 address space, they registered the company in Belize so that it could tap into V4 address space from organizations in Latin America. However, DDoSGuard does not have a physical presence in the region, which violates the rules qualifying access to that address space. And Ron Gilmet found them out and blew the whistle.
So this is what I mean about the IP addresses going to less than desirable. There is a company called DDoSGuard, which is apparently, according to the stories, Russian operated, but registered in various countries around the world, including the UK and Switzerland. And they used the IPv4 addresses they got out of AFRINIC, as well as addresses from LACNIC. So in this case, DDoSGuard established a shell company in Belize, got hold of more IPv4 addresses, and is now able to offer services to, darknets and a whole range of less than excellent quality systems. I guess it's like extrajudicial, so outside of any sort of jurisdiction. The Russians don't care because it's not affecting Russian citizens, and they're out there hosting, you know, sites that cause a lot of trouble, like 8chan, you know?
Right.
And without trying to express any political linkage, because politics and tech is inextricably linked these days, you really can't get away from it. DDoSGuard is one of the organization that's currently hosting Parler.com, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens if DDoSGuard loses those IPv4 addresses and is no longer able to host that content, because those people will, in a politically charged environment, may, you know, make various noises about it. And the answer is that the hosting provider they chose obtained IP addresses with falsehoods, on bordering on illegal, although technically defined legal when it's a NIC, right? But certainly not above board. The idea is that LACNIC issues IP addresses for organizations operating in Latin America. And if you're not operating in Latin America, and you're not a fully registered company in Latin America, you shouldn't be getting those addresses. Same for me in Europe, or if Drew set up a company in America. Yeah.
Yeah, so Brian Krebs, who does a lot of security reporting, he has a good story on this, and he notes that LACNIC has published a notice on its website saying that we'll revoke thousands of IPv4 addresses from DDoSGuard, including the IP addresses assigned to Parler. So, yeah, trying to avoid that tech political overlap here, but yeah, I guess Parler is getting booted once again.
Yeah, so another sign that the NIC organizations aren't operating optimally. And, you know, my previous criticisms a few weeks ago about the ISOC not keeping up to date here, and how the Internet Society is not keeping an eye on the institutions that it delegated responsibilities to and checking that they're audited, is something to be concerned about. And it can affect you as a company. Like, if you're operating a corporate network, those networks are basically relying on everybody else to not be awful. It's a common good. And if people can get access to addresses unregulated like this, they can be awful without restriction.
Yeah. And tip of the cap to Ron Gilmet. It's kind of amazing what an individual independent researcher with a little time, I guess, and motivation can do.
Yeah. Amazing work. Like, find out that the company, you know, he worked it out and then contacted somebody in the country to do the searches. And like, it's hard work. That is not easy work.
It is hard work. Yeah. No, not at all. Yeah, so links in the show notes if you want to learn more. We'll move on. Juniper Networks reported their fourth quarter and full year financial results for the quarter. Juniper posted revenues of $1.2 billion, up just 1% year over year, and net income of $30.8 million. For the full year, Juniper took in $4.4 billion, which is flat year over year, and net income of $257 million, down 25% year over year.
Yeah, so Rami Rahim said to analysts in their call, we grew our enterprise business for a fourth consecutive year. We grew our cloud business for a second consecutive year and made progress stabilizing our service provider business with orders in this vertical, growing on a full year basis, even though revenue declined. We've had this story based on what I read of the evidence that Juniper is turning back to the enterprise to look as a growth market for its business, having been focused more on service providers for a sustained period. And they've been able to get some growth in the enterprise business and also in their cloud business, providing cloud providers with the equipment they don't have and that they want. But the market hasn't been so pleasant. They've sort of pointed out that Juniper's got a good story at the current run rate. Their business is going to tick over quite well and they're stabilizing the business, but there's no growth story there. And of course, Rami Rahim said, capturing the value presented by our recent acquisition and making sure that 128 technology, good acquisition, by the way, Abstract, very good acquisition, and NetRounds really, really deliver similar returns on investment to what we are seeing with Mist, which continues to exceed expectation and positively impact sales of the broader portfolio. So I think Rami's making a point there. He's bought these companies which fill in the gaps or replace technologies which haven't gotten traction with customers, and there's something there in the future. I can go with that story, but I don't think analysts would. They would say that's not necessarily guaranteed. And a success with Mist doesn't necessarily translate into success with 128 Technology, Apstra, and NetRounds, of course. So be interesting to see.
Yeah, I think Mist was a great acquisition for Juniper. It finally gave them their own WLAN portfolio and also injected AI into their veins, which they are now spreading throughout the entire portfolio, at least on the enterprise side. Apstra and 128 Technology, I think, were a signal to Juniper, to enterprises, saying we're committed to the enterprise market. We're committed to this, you know, automation play, particularly with Apstra in the data center. So we'll see how well they integrate and how much uptake there is. But, you know, Juniper very much saying, yes, we are committed to enterprise. We're going forward that way.
Yeah, I see that as sort of becoming a growth market for them. But, you know, as we just talked about, Cisco's got new products coming out. Dell's in that market. HPE's got a renewed focus, you know, obviously with their range of acquisitions recently, getting back into networking. So they have got a tough fight on their hands. And instead of it, you know, the market is different now. It's really Cisco, Juniper, HPE, and Dell, I think. Whereas it used to be all of the, well, and Nokia as well, of course.
Right. Yeah, right. Nokia getting into it with SR Linux, that network operating system. HPE with Aruba, the acquisition, both in the WLAN. And now Aruba is competing hard in switching. And if you're sticking around for the Tech Bytes, you can hear about their data center automation software. So yeah, there's lots of competition for Juniper.
It's funny to reflect on where we were all those years ago. You know, there was the seven companies. It was Cisco had 80% of the market and the other six had much less. And now it seems like it's much more balanced. And, you know, the Cisco continues to dominate the market with, you know, more than half of the market share, but it's much less dominant than it was, say, 10, 15 years ago, which is a change.
That's right. Which is a change and good for you, you know, as an engineer and purchase, as somebody who buys products, you can always play them against each other. So take that to your advantage.
Yeah, and we're also seeing genuine innovation here. So, you know, Juniper's into AI with the Mist acquisition and bonding it across its portfolio and rapidly, you know, acquiring companies like Apstra. The NetRounds acquisition is really interesting. I think it'll take a while to be integrated. We did a podcast with them recently, disclosure. It was a sponsored podcast. HPE, of course, bought Plexi. I think HPE might be missing the telemetry or the visibility part, that ability to monitor the network. And they need to work hard on that part. And Dell, of course, is, I would say, is occupying the bottom end of the market. Extreme's doing its thing too. I watch Extreme, but I don't have a lot to say about that. They don't seem to be doing stuff that I want to bring. But it's just interesting to reflect on that transition and see the resurgence of enterprise networking. You know, everybody talks about cloud and public cloud a lot of the time, and yet here these companies are spending, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars on bringing new products to the enterprise. I don't think the cloud is... The evidence isn't there for the cloud.
We've talked about this a lot, but I think especially if you're going after hyperscalers, that's a dangerous market because they have the resources and the internal development chops to essentially go to ODMs and OEMs and say, build this to our specifications, and we don't need the Junipers and the Ciscos and the Nokias of the world necessarily. So trying to sell to that, like we've seen Arista and HPE in particular get burned in some ways by the cloud. So yeah, the enterprise is a reliable customer.
And there's lots of them. Nice, stable, predictable income, which is what the stock market wants for public company.
All right, next story. F5 reported their financial results for Q1 2021. They had $625 million in revenue for the first fiscal quarter, up nearly 10% year over year. Their net income of $88 million is down versus last year's income of $99 million.
Yeah, not much to say here. I think last quarter, F5 was sort of struggling and their share price fell by quite a few percentage points on the announcement. It's fairly clear that F5 Networks is working its way through the hardware to software transition. So it's still, you know, a lot of customers still think of F5 as you buy a piece of hardware and you put it in the front of the firewall stack and that's all it does. And it really isn't. But its acquisitions like Volterra and Nginx really were very high priced. They paid very highly for them, and they're not really integrated into the portfolio. George Notter from Jefferies, which is a major analyst firm, said the Nginx, Shape and Volterra acquisitions will take 12 plus months to begin driving meaningful revenue growth as F5 has still to integrate the business and develop an integrated product customer strategy. I agree with that. In that they've made these acquisitions, but they all still look like separate products. You know, if you're going to bring these things together, you've got a security product, like the load balancer thing is now a security product. Okay. Shape Security is part of that, makes it better. Volterra is another part, but that's like nowhere. That's like barely out of startup. It barely even had a product ready. Nginx is a much more mature, but you've got all those legacy customers. You don't want to lose them because you need the money coming in. So you've got to take a lot of care and time to make whatever Nginx does not. So I'm not sure that there's any growth in F5 long term. And that's basically what most of the analysts are saying, is that F5's doing okay, but there's not much of an up story here. And the share market values growth, not where you are. They value where you're going to.
That's right. And as we see more application development moving into the public cloud, that's obviously F5 can't sell you a hardware load balancer, so they need a solution there. And I think that was part of the Volterra acquisition. And in the enterprise, they're seeing renewed competition from folks like VMware, who are heavily into software-based load balancing and security.
Yeah, I mean,
tough for F5.
That's the key bit here, is everything F5 does, somebody else is already doing. So if you're going to do security, well, what about, you know, we just talked about Fortinet or Palo Alto. You know, they've got much more convincing strategies there around security. If you're going to do service mesh, Nginx is a good player, but there's plenty of others, right? If you're going to add security, you know, some sort of security and the service mesh together, plenty of players in that. That's a very crowded, like that's an obvious market. And the Volterra acquisition just continues to baffle me. So they paid $500 million for Volterra, and I'm like, ah.
We spent a long time on it in a recent episode. Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, there you go.
All right, our last story for this episode, the networking software startup DriveNets has raised $208 million in a B round of funding. DriveNets targets service providers and hyperscalers with a network virtualization play.
Well, so we've talked a lot about network operating systems on packet pushes, heavy networking over the last 2 years, and DriveNets is a company in this space. But what makes them different is that they're actually taking disaggregated solutions. So you go and buy your white box Ethernet switches, and then uses them to bond them into a unified device, so a chassis. So this is effectively a chassis replacement technology. And the way that it works is you basically buy a couple of x86 servers, and that's your management plane. You buy a couple of switches, and then they become the backplane of the chassis and the control plane. So they do all of the communication between the switches, signaling the each one. And then you buy a bunch of switches that turn into the front end, and they can turn these low-cost white boxes or low-cost standard 1RU, 2RU switches into 768 terabytes of forwarding performance.
Wow. Right?
So I didn't pay much attention to what DriveNets were doing, because we've seen other companies do this. Arcus is doing it with their NOS, emphasizing their distributed work forwarding. And there are other companies out there doing the same. There's about four, I think there's four or five of them. But to get $208 million, it seems a lot.
It's a big investment. Yeah. And they're also touting AT&T as a customer. So that's also a nice win for them. So let me, is the value proposition here for DriveNets that you don't have to buy a really expensive piece of routing hardware? You can do this with white box and their fancy software.
That's right. Yeah. You just install the system the way you want, and it looks like a chassis. So instead of, you know, going and buying a big Cisco router that takes up two racks and it's one single piece of metalwork with a bunch of custom cards that go inside it, this is an Ethernet forwarding plane basically made out of commodity components, and you should be able to mix and match. So if you're a telco, you can scale it from one to, you know, however many units it takes to get to 768 terabytes. You know, you deploy the first one and then scale it out to leaf spine architecture fundamentally. And then there's a couple of switches connecting them all together, which is normal. That's how a chassis works, right? It's not.
But there's also like a capacity sizing here play. I don't have to build out by buying equipment I'm not necessarily going to use in anticipation of that eventually being used, because I can scale it up as needed.
Well, if you think about a 5G base station, so at the edge of your network, you're going to put these 5G towers, and in there you're looking at 100 or 200 ports. Well, maybe today it's 100 ports or 50 ports, but tomorrow it might be 500 ports because you need to grow it. As the radios get more complicated, you put more servers in and things like that.
Yeah.
If you're buying a chassis from, you know, your traditional supplier and it's an 8-slot chassis and it has these line cards that are, you know, often 6 to 10 times the price of a standard 1RU switch, you've got to keep stock of those line cards. You can't, like, and they don't do anything different to a normal switch. They just happen to be loaded in a single piece of metal. So it looks like one unit. And that's the convenience of it. It looks like one thing. It doesn't look like 6 switches or 8 switches or 12 switches. It looks like one operational unit. And if something breaks, you just go out, pull out the one that's broken, replace it with another one. And they're commoditized. So in theory, you can be a lot easier to maintain the spare parts and so forth.
Yeah, that's interesting because I'm thinking about, we just talked about Juniper. When I was looking at their numbers, their routing business is still the, you know, the primary financial engine for them. They got $1.6 billion for the full year out of it compared to the other business units. So something like DriveNets, they're maybe looking at this and going, huh.
That's right. Where they might buy a chassis-based router from Juniper or Cisco or Nokia or Ericsson, they might look at this and go, this makes more sense for us in a repeatable model. Potentially, or, you know, and those backbone networks need big ass routers in them. You know, if you're terminating 400 gigs of DWDM and you've got to route those packets, how are you going to do it?
Right.
So there's still a market there for that. You know, if you're routing 400 gig, you're still going to be doing the custom routers. Because if you're terminating 20, 30, 50, 100, 400 gig ports, commodity switches aren't going to cut that necessarily. But maybe DriveNets is making a pitch that it can. If you go out and buy a 400 gig, you know, Jericho from Broadcom, that's got 32 400 gig ports on it. Maybe,
Yeah. Well, at $208 million in a Series B, they just made it a lot more expensive for somebody to buy DriveNets.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting story.
Yeah. All right. Well, that wraps up our news portion. Stay tuned for the Tech Bytes conversation with Aruba. We'll be talking about their data center network automation software, Fabric Composer. You can check it out right now. You're listening to the Tech Bytes podcast from the Packet Pushers. Today's show dives into the Aruba Fabric Composer. This is data center software that can automate the provisioning of your network underlay and overlay, plus other nifty features for orchestration, visibility, and troubleshooting. Aruba Networks is our sponsor, and our guest is Simon McCormick. He is Senior Manager for Product Management at Aruba. Simon, welcome to the podcast, and can you briefly get us acquainted with Fabric Composer and what it does?
Absolutely. Thanks, Drew. Yeah, Fabric Composer, this is orchestration for Aruba switches, primarily focused on the data center environment. Now, why would anyone want this? If you're building data center topologies today, there's a lot of state-of-the-art standards that you'll go through. And I'll use the terms leaf spine, underlay overlay, EVPNs. These are all technologies you have to build on your switches and configure. We can massively simplify this. So if you're new and maybe an experienced customer, we can save you a ton of time, both on day zero configurations, but also day one and day two, as you modify and work with this topology later.
And I think the key here is that you're not just simplifying the setup, because the setup is important, making it easier to buy products and get them into the network. Like, we used to be in a situation where it would take months to do to go through the buying cycle and then the deploying cycle, if not years for some customers, you know, spanning tree and standards and blah, blah, blah. What we're talking about here is the ability to plug everything in, add the Aruba Fabric Composer. It automatically recognizes everything, reaches out and starts doing the composition of the initial configurations. And then you start configuring VLANs and segments and it's all the BGP EVPN and the VXLAN overlays and all that stuff. That's all just taken care of for you.
Yeah, let me tell you a few customer stories. We've had customers that have said, we're not ready for leaf spine yet. We're staying in a pure layer two environment. We've had customers say, I haven't quite got EVPNs yet, so they haven't moved to it. Just because from their perspective, it's a little complicated. And there's a massive benefit to going to the full leaf spine EVPN overlay, because you make your layer three and layer two connectivity so much easier down the road. So just making the best this fabric provisioned. So we have bite-size workloads that you can, at your choice as a customer, use any of these bite-size workloads. And these are UI-driven, which sounds terrible to me. I don't want to use a UI to do it. Actually, this architecture we've built for this product is all fully API automated. So if you've got a API automation framework, we actually make it very easy for you to actually use these workloads.
Right.
So does this mean there's special software running on the Aruba switches that's talking to some kind of controller, or just software sitting off to the side? How are the switches talking to Fabric Composer?
Yeah, Fabric Composer is essentially a VM, can be a HA version with three VMs if you want. Fairly lightweight, easy install, just run it on VMware in your management environment if you want. Fabric Composer will talk to the switches using the switches API. So the CX switches in Aruba, they have a standard public API. We use purely the public API, no backdoor configuration to this.
And this is already available on the Aruba switches. I don't have to put anything new special agent software on the switches. It's there.
Yep, it's been available for a few years, well documented, and it's there today. Essentially, you could do everything that Fabric Composer does yourself with your Ansible scripts if you wanted to, if you could figure out all the API calls to do it. Because it's configuring EVPN at least spine is a little bit complicated. There's a lot of, you need to tell me, this port's connected to that port, this address I'm going to use on this RPI configuration. Instead, Fabric Composer will actually detect the configurations. You'll input a little bit of data, give us an internal range of addresses. Mm-hmm. We will then provision that on the switches and talk using that standard API to the switches. It gets better. There's a best practice configuration for doing this on Aruba. You can Google it and you'll find it. And there's a guide which shows you all the CLI configurations. What Fabric Composer does is it actually builds that best practice configuration. So even if you're super experienced at doing this, this is just a quick way to get to that best practice configuration. When you look at the switches, you'll be able to see, here's the CLI config that Fabric Composer's provisioned using the API.
So if I'm a CLI person and I'm not entirely happy with the SDN, the switches are still autonomous and I can still go in and CLI them and do whatever I need to do.
And that was a design decision to do that. So the answer is yes, that's exactly what it is. You can actually use Fabric Composer, provision this leaf-spine EVPN. When you're done with it, you can turn Fabric Composer off if you want and go back to doing manual CLI configurations. We don't think you want to do that, but just to get an idea.
No. Well, I was thinking about resellers. Maybe a reseller wants to use it as a fast deployment tool.
Right.
And if the customer says, well, I don't want that or whatever, you know, there are circumstances where this might actually be a, because I've worked at resellers and I know some customers are strange. They might not, you know, whatever. They have ideas and things, but the customer always wins, right? But I think the interesting part here is that you're saying the switch is still the source of truth. The switch remains autonomous, can be modified, and Fabric Composer, the Aruba Fabric Composer can adapt to this. If I feel the need to override at the CLI, Fabric Composer will still use the source of truth that's in the network.
Exactly. Well put.
So you mentioned besides just being able to automate the creation of the underlay, you can do other things, sort of day two operations. Do you have examples?
Yeah. So we discovered very early in this product's life cycle, which we can talk maybe about at the end a bit, that the data center does not just consist of switches. There's these annoying racks of servers and storage in there as well, which essentially form the network as well. It's a virtual network, a physical network. It's really all one network to us. So we built into the product this automation integration layer to work with third parties like VMware vCenter, Nutanix's Prism, and tools like that. The point is that there's servers and storage connected to these switches. Those servers and storage often have network requirements. They need some provisioning on the network team. Nothing worse than having to call the network team to do it. So we've automated that. So if you do changes in vCenter, you will find the changes automatically happening on the Aruba network if you opt into it. We don't force you to do any of this.
Right. So what you're actually saying here, I think implicitly, is that if I need to configure VLANs, that's kind of like table stakes, MLAGs to servers, table stakes, and they all go into EVPN, so they go into micro segments. The leaf spine does a layer 3, but I can still do my layer 2 just the way it does. So in effect, the Fabric Composer sets up a leaf spine network to look kind of like a legacy layer 2 if you want to do that.
Yes. I mean, it's both at the same time. So my classic demo I do, I have a bit of layer 2 and a bit of layer 3 all in the same setup. And I use the workflows to bring it up. So then I can do just basic VLAN layer 2. And then I got more complicated layer 3 all provisioned for me.
So you mentioned, provisioning from VMware. Are you saying from like a vSphere console, a VMware admin, if they have the permissions from the network side, could set up a VLAN and that will go through Fabric Composer to the switches?
Yeah. So the standard model is if you provision a new port group or vSwitch or distributed vSwitch in vCenter, Basically, that's you'll often apply some VLAN component there. The most basic model is Fabric Composer will recognize that that's happened. It will then determine if we know the location of that host, because it learns via LDP on the wire where they are housed. If it knows where it is, it'll then apply that VLAN to the associated Aruba port.
That's kind of like an intent-based networking, but you haven't used the word intent here anywhere.
Yeah, I think you know, there's many terms to describe this kind of model. I often use it as saying that's the policy has been driven in that model through vCenter, but it's essentially intent. Yeah. Now we have a little thing as well there, that we have a plugin to vCenter as well.
Yeah.
So the Fabric Composer UI actually completely sit within vCenter. You can give that vCenter operator a read-only account, and he can basically see this operation happening to make sure, you know, he's doing his bit. He doesn't want to talk to the network guy. He makes sure it happens.
I actually saw it more importantly that the networking guy doesn't want to talk to the vSphere guy.
Yeah.
So give him a read-only view. Let him go and work out what he needs to know. So I'm off doing something else, like configuring firewalls or load balancers or doing public cloud or something, right? Which is
honestly
got a better use of my time. But
much better use of your time. Yeah, and no one's taking any jobs away from them that they need to be doing. These are things that they shouldn't be doing because there's much more important things to do. Actually, we're often finding a lot of customers, these teams are actually in the data center. They are synced together, these server storage networking teams, more than ever before.
Yeah,
so this
yeah,
is this is like gold to them to be able to have the products do it.
Yeah, and to share visibility into each other and to give read-only, you know, and only intervene when it's needed. You mentioned before about the data model. We've seen quite a few vendors talk about the data model inside of their software. And one of the interesting parts is that once you've got the data model in a tool like Fabric Composer, now suddenly you've got visibility. And is that the same here?
Yeah, I mean, because to do this, in order to do this VLAN MLAG type automation, you need to have a full topology model, essentially from virtual NIC on the VM all the way to the physical devices. So we build that for our own uses, but actually we've adopted that for pure visibilities. We have a thing we call a network view and a host view, which basically shows within the ESX hosts, the virtual NIC and how that is connected throughout that virtual topology and onto the side of the Aruba physical switches. You just view that topology connectivity is a huge troubleshooting tool for, particularly for the vSphere admins who now knows that their hosts are connected correctly and it's all spliced together.
Yeah, having a simple place where I can get that virtual to physical topology view must be very useful when troubleshooting.
It's even better for NSX because we have an NSX plugin as well. If you've done NSXT, it starts to get a little bit convoluted when you're doing the new NSXT terms on top of a vCenter, and then you've got a physical network out there as well. These are just, when you go through those separate UIs, it starts, you know, you all just have to write down on a piece of paper to try and understand it. This host view model we have completely simplifies that for NSXT as well.
And I think another part about this is going to be the documentation, because when you have a data model, it's actually reading all the configurations of the switches, and quite often redacting the configurations into meaningful information like VLANs, MLAGs, you know, it's got an asset database, it's got configuration rollbacks, things like that.
I'm a bigger one into inventory databases. I know we'll often have a spreadsheet that has all our inventory, and the spreadsheet's always out of date. It doesn't quite have the right information. We essentially build self-documented data. There's a table, the data that we show in the graphical form, it's in a table form as well. So you can actually look at the table, do regex searches and sort it and actually get to essentially what's the latest inventory for my infrastructure.
Right, yeah. So I would assume that the model also keeps some sort of rollback history and a history of changes. So if you need to go back and see what was the system was like a month ago or a week ago or something, you can do that as well.
Yeah, I mean, because of the things that Fabric Composer are doing are all done by an AFC admin account on the switches. So it's actually all audited exactly what it's being done. You can compare with what an operator does. And Aruba has tools that can do a lot of diff analysis. There's a really cool demo where we do where we use the Fabric Composer to deploy some configuration. Then you look at the diff tool and you can see the CLI output changes, very powerful. You can actually roll it back with that tool as well if you decide you didn't like what Fabric Composer would do.
Yeah.
So you mentioned VMware integration. Do you do anything with vSAN if I've got storage workloads I need to plumb up?
Yeah, actually, for VMware and for Nutanix, they both, you know, VMware with vSAN, obviously there's basically a virtual storage layer. Then Nutanix has that built in to their. You can't do Nutanix without it. So they both have storage layers built in. You know, and the standard best practice I've seen from these vendors is for that. Communication, the storage communication, because it goes everywhere between the nodes, they sometimes build separate networks for it, mm-hmm. separate physical networks, which is super expensive. The key thing to know is both vSAN and Nutanix, their traffic, their storage traffic is critical to the operation of this environment. So you want to make sure that has the highest priority.
Yeah, vSAN breaks if the network's not, you know, assumed 100%. It's not very tolerant of the network as such.
Exactly. So we do a simple little thing. We'll detect, with this integration, we'll detect vSAN or Nutanix CVMs. We'll detect the NICs they're provisioned on. So they get provisioned on a virtual and physical NIC on the host. Mm-hmm. For those ports that end up on the Aruba, we'll basically apply a QoS policy to it. So this is, you've been able to do this QoS for 25, 30 years or something. I did it a long time ago. But you could do that today manually. You can manually create this policy if you want. But there's 150,000 commands to do it. We'll just basically automatically do it for you.
It's not rocket science. It's like, but the thing is that you're going to spend days calculating all the NICs and the VNICs and then the IP addresses of the vSAN. You're going to go and create a policy. You're going to apply it. What you really want is just a piece of software to do what you just said. The data that says the source of the vSAN is actually in the vSphere vSAN console, just why not just get some software to link all that data together and automatically generate the configs for you? And as long as that's the only QoS you're doing on the network, it really doesn't need to be anything else.
Exactly.
One area I want to go on to, we talked earlier about sort of people could do all of this in Ansible, but it's in one way of thinking about this is that a Ruby Fabric Composer is kind of doing it for you. Now, I'm a big fan of that. I think most enterprises should definitely have Python and Ansible skills, but they should be operating on top of a tool like Fabric Composer. That is, Fabric Composer does the things that everybody does, configures a switch, configures an eVPN. There's no value in using Ansible to configure that, but there's definite value in configuring Fabric Composer. Yes? No?
Yeah, I mean, Fabric Composer essentially presents to you a simplified northbound interface that you can program to. Instead of on a switch, the switch has to expose everything because it's basically the source of truth. Every single combination of every attribute is there on the switch. So it gets really complicated to program to. AFC, Fabric Composer, presents simplified northbound interface. So it becomes simple API calls from Ansible to Fabric Composer. Let us take care of the rest. I mean, I'm with you as well. That's how everyone should do it. And that's how everyone should be programming with Ansible.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's definite value in Python, but I think why if the vendors are going to produce these tools for you and they know how to, they're doing it for 1,000 customers, it should or might make more sense for you to be able to buy a tool like this that does that so that you can then focus on, say, integrating a help desk tool. Click a button and it goes off and queries the AFC for information. And maybe it goes off and queries vSphere for some related information, you know, or Windows. Maybe you want to get a picture of the Windows server in the vSphere with the network configuration and present that back to the help desk in a single, you know, click a button type thing. That to me is real value in the Ansible stuff, not in configuring 250 lines of eVPN code in a switch.
Yeah, and the key point about that story is that Fabric Composer, we can give you this set of workflows, but the reality is every customer environment is customized a little bit. What works for them, what is their service, and what are the things they need. That's why they need some kind of API framework to be the master of their service, you know, for a modern type of data center.
Well, Simon, we've run out of time. For folks who are intrigued by Aruba Fabric Composer and you want to find out more, you can either harass your resellers or surf over to arubanetworks.com and just search for Aruba Fabric Composer. We'll also have links in the show notes to take you right there to Aruba Fabric Composer. Thank you, Simon, for joining us, and thanks, Aruba, for being a sponsor. And last but not least, thank you for being a listener. If you like the show, you can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog. That's at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.